I just got an email.
Looks like you're in Hogwarts, man.
My background?
Yeah, we're already at Harry Potter. You get lost?
Hey, man, that'd be sweet.
Yeah, Chamber of Secrets.
Yeah, that's my...
I haven't watched those in a long time. Those are the first books. Not the first books, but I got really into those books.
And, me too, man.
Yeah, and then I watched all the movies and...
Right here?
Yeah.
This is an entire Harry Potter collectible section. What the fuck? I can't right here. This second shelf right here is got... I've got some, like... That's just worth some money.
No way.
Yeah, I got... Like, so my aunt, when Harry Potter first came out... This is so nerdy, but... When Harry Potter first came out, she was in London or something, and she got some stuff. Okay, hang on. I gotta get it.
Are we talking London, England? I'm assuming not London, Ontario.
No, London, like London, England. So this one's really cool. I don't know how much this stuff is worth, but I know there's no way you could buy this today. This was like only available, and this was like, this is not movie memorabilia. This is book memorabilia. So this is a watch that I got from her. And my dad just gave this back to me. It's a fucking...
That's insane. Blur.
So it's like a leather. It's got like a lightning bolt on or whatever.
Man, I'd wear that. When you go on showings and you see stuff like... Okay, when we were decluttering our home, I found our magic wands from Disney or whatever. Universal, yeah. Whatever.
Oh, you've gone to like the Harry Potter world?
Yeah, it was crazy.
I hate you.
Okay, well, here's the thing. I was very upset with my wife because I'm not a big ride person. I used to get car sick. I used to have to like just watch the front windshield the whole time. So anyway, we went to Universal. I think it was Universal. And we spent like $8,000 on the passes. Exaggeration, but you know what I mean? Nice.
Yeah, and it's super expensive.
Yeah, so we're all excited. It's like 8:30 in the morning. First ride of the day, she's like, hey, you love Harry Potter. Like, let's go on this Twin Dragons or something, whatever it's called. And I'm like, oh, all right. I'm like, well, I get sick. She's like, no, it's not a big deal. There's videos and pictures of me laying like on the grimy, dirty grounds of Universal. Like my face is green. So it literally was like two roller coasters that up to and for the
whole
day.
Like Gringotts.
Yeah, yeah. Whole day. So I went back to the hotel, like slept for 5 hours because my stomach was like puking.
Oh,
it was
horrible. Brutal.
I know.
Awesome. I'm so glad she made you do that.
So to this day, like if we go anywhere, I'm like, Courtney, am I gonna get sick? Or like helicopter tour of Grand Canyon, and again, there's a video of me laying on the tarmac like green after. Well, where I was getting at with this is when you go through, when your clients go through open houses or showings, and you see stuff like that, do people ever like chuckle or laugh when they see random weird things?
Oh, all the time. You know, and like something worth mentioning, I guess, to people who are selling, like, I mean, give that stuff a thought, because it can actually kind of work. Like, I've had people be more comfortable with a house after seeing some of the things in the house, like, because they don't get to know you, but they get an idea of like what you're like, right? Like, for example, you go into a place and like they have like all kinds of there was one that went in, these people clearly like tequila. They had like all these signs, like it's you know, tequila o'clock, or it's tequila Tuesday, like everywhere. And it was like, ah, these people really like tequila. And it's like, these people must be pretty chill, you know, like, and maybe they're not, who knows, but you know, they got put at ease. They thought, you know, these people seem fun. They seem like they like to have a good time. So yeah, people will see all kinds of like pictures and things like that, like funny vacation photos or Harry Potter memorabilia,
yeah.
Laid out and be like, this guy's a nerd.
I remember even like we looked at a few houses with you, and you know, you're looking at, I saw some of the books that these people had in their office. Just you peek
books,
in,
yeah,
and I saw some books. I'm like, oh yeah, I got all those books. Or like, or the guy was a bigger Jets jersey that, you know, I saw hanging in the closet, and I'm like, oh yeah, like, you know, I don't know what it is, but triggers like things that I liked. I picked out in that house, and I'm like, oh yeah, I can see my stuff there, right? So anyway, Harry Potter, that's kind of my mind.
Okay, let's get into the podcast. Episode 5. Look at us, weekly episodes, 2 weeks in a row. This is sweet. Today's episode is brought to you by, we don't have a sponsor, but it's brought to you by a listener. We have listeners. We have people that actually listen to this show. And we've been getting some really great feedback on our last episodes. If you haven't listened to it, check it out. But we had someone reach out with a question and said, hey, that they really like the show, and that our banter last time about banks and pre-approvals and such things gave them hope that maybe one day they could get a house. They are somebody who's a little bit older, I believe mid-60s, and they went through a divorce and now, you know, used to own a home. After the divorce, they've been renting, and now they feel like banks won't touch them and won't help them out, and that they're just going to have to rent forever.
No.
We all know rent, especially from my perspective, I hate renting. And the only renting that should happen is like you own a house and rent it out and collect the money.
That's the only side of it you like.
Yeah. So I have some questions that I kind of jotted down so I don't miss anything, but there's a myth. Maybe you can bust it for us to start. Is it easier to get a mortgage than a car loan?
Ooh. Well, here's the thing. I mean, currently now, in the years past, like even prior to my entering the industry, they made jokes about how simple it was to get a mortgage. It's changed where now there's a lot more structure and rules and regulations. So getting a mortgage is still, in my opinion, more difficult than anything else.
Okay.
Years past, like the jokes were like, what do they call it? Like ninja, like no income, no job, no problem, or something like that. Where I forget the acronym, but 15 years ago, it's like you just tell them what you make and then they give you a mortgage. But nowadays, no, there are a lot of rules, and for good and for bad, I think that they're put in place to make sure our economy doesn't get out of control.
So, because that's basically what happened in the States, right? In 2008, was everyone was getting a mortgage just because they asked for one, and it ended up the whole market was filled with bad mortgages that no one could pay for. And look what happened there in 2008, the housing crisis, everything down there collapsed. And
yeah. Well, I used to live down there. I lived down there in Florida in 2008, 2009 during the crisis. And I did door to door. I was a door to door salesman, and I walked about 60 hours a week in the heat.
Wow.
Doing 1 year. It was 1 year pest control services. So my company would treat their yard for bugs, and it was a great company, great service. And so I loved it. But long story short, I got to certain neighborhoods and I would be knocking on doors, and out of 10 doors, four of them would be vacant.
Oof.
And it was right after right when the crisis was happening, right when it was kind of finishing. So yeah, it's a real thing where a lot of people got houses that probably weren't ready for one and didn't know what the responsibilities were and qualified for a lot more than they could handle. And the thing about today is everyone's mad about, oh, the stress test rate, or, oh, it's, you know, I can only get approved for X amount. Well, 2-3 years ago, when interest rates were like 1.99%, and we still had to qualify people at the stress test rate. So that was 5.25 at the time, meaning that you could get a mortgage of 1.99, but we had to qualify you as if it was a 5.25 interest rate, meaning that made it a bit more difficult. Well, and everyone was mad about that. Well, I'm getting 1.99, Paul. Why do you have to qualify me at a higher rate? Well, now look, rates are high fives, you know,
exactly.
And some people are coming up for renewal, and thank goodness we didn't just give them their max at 1.99 because they wouldn't be able to afford staying in and at renewal, right? But it's nothing to do with what you asked. I forget even what you've asked me.
No, we were just talking about it. Easier to get a car loan than a mortgage. But
oh, there you go. No.
But no, I mean, that's good. And like the 2008 housing situation in the States is super, I don't know, for me, really interesting. And if anyone listening is interested, check out the movie The Big Short. Such a good movie. Really, really good to check out. So
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, really good movie. Okay, so onto this listener's question. I love that we have a listener question. That's so awesome. Is there any hope for people that have had, okay, so let's start with like experiencing credit issues. You have had in the past, or you're experiencing credit issues. Maybe you've got, you know, child support payments or things like that. So if you're, let's unpack that for a second. So if you're giving child support payments, how does that affect you? And then if you're receiving child support payments, can you count that as income?
Yes, very good question. And I would preface all this by saying there's always hope. You know, even if one lender says no to you, there's usually another lender that will entertain it. And we just, before we jumped on this podcast, I was just telling Tyler how I just had another, you know, realtor call me today saying, hey, look, you know, I had a client who just got declined at another lender. And that actual employee said, but this might fit with a mortgage broker who has more options. So there's always options if you call around, but I can do that for you. So when it comes to separations, you know, yes, you can use the spousal support or the child support as income. Each lender will look at it a little bit differently. So depending on the age of the child, you know, let's just say you're getting $600 a month child support, you're getting that income, but the child's 17 or 22, like depending on when the child support runs out. I know there's certain like guidelines on if they're in university, et cetera. But the first thing I always ask for is I need to see the signed separation agreement. That's number one. Because if you're telling me, Paul, I'm getting this amount of money, great. I need to be able to prove it to the bank that you're getting it or the lender. And I need to prove how long you're going to keep getting it. Because they don't want to lend it to you if there's one more year of that income, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I need the signed separation agreement. I look through it. And again, don't be embarrassed. I only look at the numbers. I don't read anything else. And I've seen thousands of these. So it's not like I judge anybody. So there's that. I look at it. Now, if you're paying, same thing. I need to see in writing on a signed sup agreement what your payment is, like what's the amount and how long is it ongoing for? And that's typically where it ends. So I either use it as a liability. So if you're the one paying it, no big deal. I just put it as $600 a month as a monthly, same as a car payment. Where it can get tricky is if you have a car payment and child support, you're paying both of those. Now that's $1,200 a month or whatever. Now that's a significant amount. So it can just decrease what you can buy for, but it's not a deal breaker.
Nice. Okay. Well, that's great to know. And then, so I guess if someone's coming to you, okay, maybe they've had some credit issues, they've sorted through it. Now, if you pull someone's bureau and they've had, let's say, like a credit card that's gone into bad shape or arrears or collections or anything like that, but maybe they've dealt with it, things will stick on their credit report for, I can't even remember, the 5 years, 7 years, it'll stick around on your credit bureau. Can you still get approved for a mortgage with that stuff on your bureau?
Yeah. 100%. I mean, most bureaus I see have little blips on them or little blemishes. It just comes down to the story behind it. And I will say where I differentiate myself is my team and I will actually, on your behalf, help get that fixed. So sometimes it depends on what the credit grant or how they close that thing up. So let's just say you moved and you didn't realize that you owed hydro and it went to collections and collections calls you and, oh no, you know, I owe $500. Well, if you pay it right then and there, that the hydro or the collections agency actually themselves can distinguish how they're going to code that. So they could say account paid, account closed by grant, or there's different ways. And however they code it can really impact the future. So if it just shows account paid and it went to collections, then I can get the story and say, look, you know, if you didn't know that you still owed, you thought you'd paid it off and it took 7 months to actually hear from anybody, but you paid it instantly. Well, in that scenario, that's explainable. But if it shows like closed by grantor,
what does
doesn't
that
show, sorry, it just means, let's just say like you walked away from your debts essentially in that case where the lender, whoever borrowed you that money, has at that point realized they're not going to get it from you. So they kind of like wash it off their books. They're like close, like we've tried sending it to, exactly. So there's that looks a lot worse than account paid. And I've had it where someone's like, Paul, here's the invoice. I paid it. Why is it still showing unpaid on my bureau? It's like, well, A, maybe the employee at that, whoever issued that loan or Hydro, whoever it was, maybe they didn't even remit it to Equifax. And like that happens. Everyone's a human, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So then within 3 hours, and we have a broker VIP kind of hotline where we can send that in and say, hey, look, here's the client's story. Here's what happens. And then within 3 hours, it's updated on the bureau and the credit score has jumped like 80 points. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So
that's like crazy.
Yeah, we can do that. I mean, most places won't offer you, that's extra work for me and for my team, right? But we want to get you the best options available. So we can look at it. I can coach you. I can say, hey, that TELUS thing, it's still reporting that you owe $6. Call them. No, yeah, it'll still say like unsatisfied or unpaid. Call them and pay it. And then some people will be like, Paul, I'm never paying them. It was their fault. I'm like, okay, I will give you $6, but you have to pay that off because it's holding you back.
I will give you the $6.
Yeah. So nothing is off the table. We can always work through stuff. And I've seen everything. I've seen bankruptcies, consumer proposals. There's always ways out. Then there's always options.
Awesome. Well, that's great to know. And it's probably worth saying too, that if you are somebody that has had, you know, credit challenges in the past and you're approaching the idea of purchasing a home, like, hey, you know what, be prepared to maybe have to go dig through your paperwork a little bit and have to find those receipts that show paid or get that documentation. You might have to make those phone calls and it sucks. Nobody likes to do that kind of stuff. If that's what it's going to take to get you a house, then start digging, you know, keep that stuff, call people around, whatever. And I think, you know what, Paul, like even on my side of the business too, I'll speak for the two of us and say, you're dealing with professionals here. Don't let your situation hold you back from making a phone call and reaching out and trying to get yourself into a better position. We're here to help people That's our whole job, right? We're not here to take a look at what happened to you and judge. That's not our job, and don't have time for that anyway.
No. And like, I kind of always make it sound like it's what I always say. I'm like, look, you know, I'm like a doctor who does thousands of physicals a year. Like, I've seen it all, like nothing, you know, I'm desensitized to it all. Right. Like, I doesn't matter to me what's happened. I just want to help you get in the right spot. And then I would say too that it's better to do it first. So a lot of people will tell me, no. Like, I don't want you to pull my credit. I don't want to get documents. I just want to know what I'm pre-approved for. Can you do that? And I say, I'm like, well, okay. If you want that, sure. Take your salary times 3.75. That's the mortgage you can get approved for if you have good credit and you have zero debts. So if you make $100,000 a year gross, you know, times 3.75 means you can get a mortgage of $375,000. So on top of that, put your $20,000 down payment, 25. Now you're buying a $400,000 house. So that's the quick 3.75 times your qualifying income. What that means, though, that's the income that I can actually use. So if it's like 1 month on a contract job, that doesn't count. But that's the easy one. But then I say, if you want to actually go into an offering situation and feel confident, let's get your application form. Let's look at your credit. And it's not going to be a big ding. Everyone's worried about their credit score, their credit rating. Yeah. If I do it up front once, it might your score might go down by, I don't know, 5 to 8 points. But within a couple of weeks, it's right back where it was. And there's much more risk in waiting. I've seen so many things where people didn't know that they owed money that we can fix for them. So it's worth it. Do it up front, and I'm here to help.
Cool. So someone comes to you and like, what would you say their bare minimum is to get qualified for a mortgage? And maybe from like a credit score perspective, and like, cause obviously income is your income. There's no minimum. It'll just depend on what you can afford. But, from a credit standpoint, what would you say the minimum is that somebody needs to have to get approved?
Great question. So the issue is people will come to me, Paul, I've got amazing credit. I've seen it online, Credit Karma, my big bank website tells me what my credit is. I'm a nerd. So I went to a credit seminar and they talk about, depending on the type of product you're trying to get approved for, you'll have like six different credit scores. So if you're trying to get a mortgage, you'll have a different credit score than if you go to try and get a car loan. And the reason is for each of those different types of loans, there's different factors that those issuers put more weight on. So for instance, if you're buying a mortgage, like they'll look at how long have you had established credit? You know, is your repayment history really good versus other things like a car loan might not be as worried about how long have you been establishing credit? Like there's just different factors that they punch in and it gives you a different number. So depending on what you're trying to buy, you'll have multiple different scores. Now, the free ones on Credit Karma and stuff are just pulling like a generic smattering of all those issues, all those different types of credit versus mortgages are, again, I don't know the actual algorithm, but just know that. So
I've always wondered that, you know, to be honest, because like I use one myself. I like to keep tabs on my credit and things like that. So I use one of those free things. I always wondered, is this really my score? Is this just a product that's trying to feed me information to sell me stuff, you know, things like that. So I always take it with a grain of salt. I look at it and I go, okay, that's the number, but is that really the number?
Well, yeah. And I wish I could grab my notes, but basically there's, you know, we call mortgages typically use a FICO. I think it's called a FICO 8. So there's different codes for them, but yeah, looking at it and looking at whatever you have is at least better than not looking at all. And then what also gets confusing is some of those online sites will show you a TransUnion score. And so TransUnion and Equifax are two different companies, two different scales. So a number on either, like if you got a 700 on Equifax and a 700 on TransUnion, it means different things. So I always say, glad you've looked at your credit, but let's look at it on my side to show you what a mortgage issuer will look at and how they'll see your credit. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. Does age have anything to do with getting approved for a mortgage?
No, it doesn't. It can't. And in Canada, you can't discriminate based on age.
So now, a bank wouldn't be like, oh, by the time this mortgage comes up, you know, for like 25 years from now, if you're a 70-year-old person, you're going to be 95 by the time you're done paying this off. Most people don't live to 95, you know, that kind of thing. Because that's what people think.
No. And for the viewers, and maybe even Tyler, who didn't, I guess, wasn't attentive enough, I may have smirked a little bit when I said that. Yeah. So like the politically correct answer is no one can, and no one should discriminate based on age. Now, some places will, because like Tyler mentioned, you know, if a client's 88 years old and they want to put down, you know, 10%, 20% and buy a home with a 25-year amortization, well, you know, that's quite longer than the average lifespan in Canada, right? So they can't technically and legally do it, but they might ask questions. They might ask for a bigger down payment and maybe not tell you why, because if it's later in life, they wouldn't want to saddle the estate with like a longer, like a massive mortgage, and a long time left on the AM. So rule of thumb is no, they can't. I mean, okay, if you're in the late 70s, late 80s, then maybe we talk about stuff like lines of credit, like a HELOC. Maybe we talk about a reverse mortgage. There's options we could talk about. But letter of the law is no one can decline you based on your age. They might just look at like a shorter amortization, that type of thing.
How many mortgages did you say you do? Put you on the spot. For someone like in their mid-60s?
Oh, quite a few. Mid-60s all the time. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it's not unreasonable to live to your mid-80s in Canada. Even if you're in your mid-60s, 20 years, like I wouldn't worry about that.
Not at all. It's more if you're 88 years old, then, you know, then it's talking about like, you know, different, like, do you really want to live in a home on your own? Right. So, but yeah, 60s, no problem. No, 70s, you know, not a big deal.
Excellent. I only asked that specifically because our viewer did mention mid-60s for themselves. So, I mean, so that's pretty good. So hopefully that gives this viewer a good kind of window to look into that. Yeah, don't lose hope. Don't think that a mortgage is unattainable. There are plenty of options from Paul's side of things by the sounds of it. And then there's also other assistance too. Like from my side of things, there's the first time home buyers incentive. So, you know, if you're a first time buyer, there's programs available to kind of help things there. So a brief overview of that program. Yep. But yeah, you know, you got to save up your 5%. Government will give you an additional 5% on an existing home, 10% if it's a new build. And then the cool thing is you don't pay that back until you sell the house, unless you adjust the mortgage, refinance, port it, move it to somewhere else. They'll give you an additional 5%. So your total down payment becomes 10%. So now you only have to take a mortgage for 90% of the purchase instead of 95% of the purchase, which lowers your monthly payments and makes things a little more manageable. So there's, you know, you got to qualify for that. And I think it's like you can't make more than 120 grand a year if you're in the GTA or Vancouver or whatever. It's like 150,000 or something like that. It's been a while since I talked about this, so it's going off memory.
Yeah, I think it's 125. I think that's the combined family income. Okay. In Canada. And then some of the major metropolitan areas, like I think they'll increase that amount. But yeah, the other thing too is there's a qualifying amount I know as well, where to stay within the threshold of the program, I think it's like the mortgage amount can't exceed 4 times your income plus the down payment. So if your income is 100 grand that we're using to qualify, 4 times that is 400,000. The down payment was going to be your 5% down. That's 20 grand. And I guess if you're using their income, I think it's 40. So you'd qualify for 420 or 440 based on that math. But there's a few, but that's what we would do. Case by case, we look at the qualifications on their behalf. Yeah.
Yeah. I just did some quick math. So say, you know, you're buying a house for 350,000. You got to save 17,500 on your own. Government would give you an additional 17,500, giving you a total down payment of $35,000 that you would then be able to, that amount would come off the 350. So now you're mortgaging a smaller amount of money and you don't have to pay it back until you sell. And 1 second, Paul. Paul has a question and his hand is up. There are no like payment options either for this. This is you have to pay it back in one lump sum. So you go to sell your house, there's like a charge on your title that the government of Canada, you owe them $17,500. And basically when you sell, they get their money back first, and then you would be able to claim the rest of the proceeds of the sale. If you want to port your mortgage to a new address, you got to pay them back. If you want to refinance, sure, you're entitled to 80% of your equity after you pay back the government of Canada. There's 17,500.
And as I was trying to rudely interrupt, you cover most of it. What I was going to say was they will take back that 5% of whatever the home is valued at the time of paying them back. So it's not just 17,000. Yeah. Not the 17,500 that they lent you up front.
Of course they make money on this.
Oh yeah. Well, and I mean, and people make, and like, I'm cool with that because like they're borrowing you this money. What's the They are the ones that are they're up front. They're giving that extra money. So I guess they do need to profit, you know, make.
And it does get tied up for 25 years, potentially, if you don't leave that house.
So, yeah. Or then I've heard, like, when someone asked me, Paul, in 9 years, if I'm ready to do a ton of renovations, should I pay it back prior to the renovations? And it's like, well, yeah, if you have the cash, get it appraised and do the right process. But they would send an appraiser out there and say, okay, now it's worth 390 in your example. So we want 5% of 390, but do that before you put 80 grand into the home. And now it's worth 470 because you only 5% of what it gets appraised at.
Ooh, there's a nice little detail. That's good to know. Perfect. That's why we have people like you, Paul. I just find the houses.
Yeah, no, and that's fine. Anyway, and in time, there's always a couple people that will look at the file and the lender and the lawyer. And there's typically, you know, the legal costs. So there's a second, like you said, a second charge. So your legal costs are maybe a tiny bit more as well. But yeah, it's a good program for some people. And I always advise based on like the actual file, I'll say, yeah, you're a good candidate for this program. Yes or no. And up to that client, whether or not they want to take that into consideration.
Nice. Okay, so we've talked about people who credit challenges, all that fun stuff. What about folks who are new to Canada? It's a very common thing right now. We have a lot of new folks coming in via immigration into the country, and they all need places to live. There's quite a bit here on your side of the business and on my side of the business. And on my side, there's actually a foreign buyer ban on right now where, you know, you can't purchase a house in Canada unless you are a permanent resident of the country. Now, there are some minor exceptions and there's some variations in the rules. So take that with a grain of salt. Depending on your situation, you still might be able to purchase a home. But for the most part, you know, right on the CMHC website, it says effective January 1st, 2023, the prohibition on the purchase of residential property by non-Canadians prevents non-Canadians from buying residential property in Canada for 2 years. Like I said, some things where depending if you're outside a census metropolitan area, you can purchase, you know, if you're way out in the middle of nowhere, if you're purchasing a multifamily unit with four or more units, you can still purchase, but three or units or less, you can't. And the thing is like, this is heavily enforced. So if a non-Canadian purchases or somebody like myself, a realtor, helps them purchase knowingly, knowing that they're not a Canadian citizen, fines up to $10,000 can be put into place. So folks who are new to Canada, that's one thing that you kind of got to dance around. But you know, if you've been here for 2 years and you're still not a permanent resident, what are their options from a financial perspective?
Great question. And there's different avenues to go down here. So there's a couple things where there's an actual program called New to Canada with Sagen. So think of CMHC, like the mortgage default insurance, you know, when you're putting down less than 20%, there's an actual program called New to Canada. And what that's meant for is clients that haven't established like your standard Canadian credit score, you know, you're 2 years on the job, you're 1 year, you know, you're out of university and you're nursing now for 4 months. Like that's different. Like, so typically people say, oh, Paul, like, do I need 2 years on a job or a year on a job? Depends what type of income. So if you have like a degree and your job is in the same field as your education, this is for standard Canadian applicants. You know, typically if you've been on your permanent full-time job for off probation and a few months longer than that, you're good. If you know, have worked a more hourly type of job for 2 years and I can show what you typically make, that's fine. Now for someone new to Canada, they may not have, they're just moved here. They haven't done the university degree in Canada. They might not have permanent full-time employment right away. They might not have 2 years of hourly history. So it's a bit more challenging. So the New to Canada program that I talk about is, all right, you've been here for less than 5 years. If you've been here less than 5 years and you haven't really established credit yet, there's other alternative sources. So they can look at, okay, let's see your rent payments for the last couple of years. Let's see your cell phone bill for the last 12 months. Like if you don't have long history of established Canadian credit, we can look at alternatives. Or we can look at your international credit report to show that you had history in the country you came from. But the biggest thing is they want to still see 3 months of on the job at a permanent full-time employment. So if you have 3 months on the job, permanent full-time, you just got off your probation and you only have 3 to 6 months of Canadian credit, it's not a deal breaker, but we have to look at. Yeah, we have to look at some things. Now that's in that scenario, you're a permanent resident. If you're on a visa, that's a bit challenging too, where different lenders will say, okay, you're on a work visa and it expires in 2 months. No, doesn't work. Some will say if it expires, you have six months left, then they'll look at doing it. Some will say they want a year left on your work visa. So different lenders will let you buy while on a work permit.
Okay.
But there's other things to look at. Then they want to make sure that the job is really good, you know, like really seen as like a reputable company, permanent full-time, and you've applied for PR, you know? So there are ways to do it. And there's different people throw out the word new to Canada. There's just different ways to use it, but there's always an option. Work permit, you have fewer options. But once you have PR and you have a few months on a permanent job, then we can work with that too.
Nice. So 3 months on the job, all that fun stuff. Obviously you gotta have some sort of income, that kind of thing, options available for them. That's fantastic. If you're new to Canada and you're looking to buy a house and you're thinking along the same lines as this other listener was thinking, like, hey, there's no chance for me. Definitely not the case. You can still purchase a home, but biggest things to deal around is just proving that income and the foreign buyer ban that we're currently dealing with. So we just might have to take a look at how long you've been here, things like that.
Yeah. And it's funny that you bring that this is the topic today, because I just talked about that was this with someone where I literally had a follow-up from 1 year ago where I said, let's touch base in a year. We'll give you a chance to get permanent full-time positions and to build your credit up a bit. And it was a year later and now we're pre-approved. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So again, could we have done it in less than a year? Yeah, but it all depends on as fast as you can get your permanent full-time position. That's when we can start working with your situation, whether it's work permit or permanent residence. We can start working on it once you get the job. That's the most important part. And the down payment, it's good if they have at least saved up. It's good to show if you've saved up 5% at least of your own funds. You can still get some gifted money. And actually, I believe that some lenders will also let you have 100% of your down payment being gifted from a direct family member. But where it gets challenging is what country is the money coming from? So just talk with me. I'll walk you through everything. Clients, I'm talking to you specifically. Like if you have questions, I'll walk you through your options and the fastest way to buy a home.
Yeah, because that was the question I was going to say. Is like, okay, so especially with folks that are coming from other countries, you know, typically they're going to have funds from that country. And I know we've touched on this in a recent episode. Can you just bring money from, well, exclude Russia right now. We all know Russia's got some issues, some challenging situations to get funds out of Russia. But say you're coming out of, you're moving here from London. I don't know. This first one that came to head.
Yeah.
But say you're moving here from London, right? And you've got money there and you want to bring it here. Like, can you just e-transfer that to yourself and use it right away as a down? I'm sure there's a better way of getting your money from London to Canada, but you know what I mean?
Duffel bag. No, yeah. But it's interesting. So the country does matter. First off, I look at the Canadian sanction list. So there's a list of countries that Canada will not accept money from or often travelers from, right? Like just based on political things that are going on in the world. So first off, I look at what country is the money coming from. And then secondly, yeah, if it's like a Commonwealth nation, like from our old British colony days, I guess you'd say, so like England or Australia or whatever, it's going to be a bit easier to get money, especially if it's in Canadian, in English. So we want to see bank statements, right? So if you are taking money from a different country, if it's coming from, let's just say India, for instance, you know, some banks will want to make sure that you've paid a third party interpreter to translate the documents, the bank documents, showing that money came from your own account in India. And that can be expensive. And they might have a list of approved interpreters. And so I've come across that. I've had some people from like Japan and their bank would only issue them English statements if they went in person and they were already back here in Canada. So stuff like that. So I'll walk you through the options, but it's easier if it's an account that your name is on and it's in English. And I always tell people, if you know you're going to be buying in the next month to 2 years, or get the money now so it sits, because there can be holds as well, like we talked about, where even if I can use the funds for a mortgage, like me as the broker, I have no say in whether FinTrack, like there's, it's called FinTrack, like financial tracking. So if the government puts a hold on anything coming in, it can sit in your institution on hold for, I don't know, 10 days, 20 days, right?
Yeah, so definitely.
Even though I think that on my end, the country's fine and that you can use it, I have no say over if your bank is told to put a hold on it, right? Until it clears everything. So get it over sooner, faster, before you're offering. Yeah.
Well, and lastly, so we've talked about the fact that there is hope for people. If you want a house, put a plan in place to get a house, you know, and meet with a realtor. If you're in Winnipeg, call me. Mm-hmm. Meet with a mortgage broker. If you're in Winnipeg, call Paul.
Anywhere in Canada.
Yeah, Paul, you're not restricted like I am. You can go anywhere in Canada. So that's definitely, and like not just to pump your tires, but that's definitely worth noting and putting out there that, you know, folks, like you're available to do mortgages from coast to coast, you know? So if you've picked up this podcast and you're in BC and you just think Paul sounds like the right guy to manage your mortgage, call him. He can do it for you. Now, the other question that this viewer had was, okay, so maybe I can't get a mortgage, but can I even afford anything? You know, the economy is tough right now. It is a challenge to get anything at a reasonable price. It seems everything is just more and more expensive. Plus you got to put a tip on everything, but that's a whole other conversation.
I always feel so awkward. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, especially if I'm just picking something up that like I ordered online or whatever, like,
yeah.
I'm picking up like a freshy bowl and my bowl of salad with some rice on it's already going to be $21. And it's like, again, like I grew up in the service industry. So I love to spread the love, right? Cause that's how I paid for my schooling. But if you're picking up something online or like, I don't know.
See,
I am a sucker for it though. I'm a sucker.
Yeah,
for it.
I know. And like, that's why they're doing it. I've kind of read into it a little bit and that's why they're doing it. And I have taken the stance and I know not everyone's going to love this, but like, if you provide a service, you'll get a tip. Like for me, like you go to a restaurant, you have a server who's coming back. They're making sure your food was right. They're bringing the food to you. They're making sure your drink is full. That deserves a tip. In my opinion, going to Subway and ordering a sandwich and getting the sandwich that I ordered is like, for me, like that's not something, unless you got like a really, like really great service. Like there is a local guy in Oak Bank who does a fantastic job at Subway and I will tip him every time because he talks to you. He's nice. He really makes sure that your sandwich is made like properly. There's nothing worse than getting, and I know this is Subway specific and whatever, but getting a sandwich and opening it up and it's just a mess.
Yeah, no, that's the worst.
You know, you pick something up and that's the thing is like, sometimes you don't see this food. Like you go through a drive through like Starbucks or whatever. And like Starbucks is the worst for me. And like, I'm a big coffee guy. I don't go to Starbucks a lot. It's not my favorite blend, but you go there and they want a tip. And then and it's like, if you order food, it's pre-made sandwich that's mic'd, put in a microwave and then handed to you. And like, to me, I'm like, why am I tipping you for this?
No. And like, I even went to like I said, I love, like you said, where there's a service provided. I love to tip. Like I loved, especially because like that's how I grew up and that's how I paid for school. So, but like, for instance, like literally today, this morning, I went to a market where I picked up like a wine basket and I just brought it to the counter and paid for it. And it was like, do you want to pay? And again, it's the percentage of the purchase price, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, do you want to pay 10 bucks, 15 bucks, 20 bucks or 25 bucks or whatever, and I'm for a tip or whatever. I'm like, whoa, like I just typed it in. You know what I mean? But I still had to panic. I'm like, oh, am I going to look like a loser if I don't give 10 bucks? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Weird.
And it's like, everything's so expensive. And it's like, yeah, sure. I'd love to add another 20% to my already overpriced product here, you know, like, and for me, it's like, I eat, I'm on the go a lot. So I'm constantly going through restaurants and getting food on the go. And for me, that's where I've really noticed it. I even stopped to get a case of beer the other day. It was a self-serve beer vendor. And you go to the counter and there was a tip option. And I was like, for what?
You know what, dude? I've even had it where like, even recently I went to a place where I used to work back in my serving days. And now the employees the tips are getting put on their T4. So like you're paying taxes on your actual tips as well. At this place, they were telling me that like now all the tips are on credit cards. So now it gets added to your like pay stub and get source deductions and tax on it that way, right? So
I was always wondering too, like, how does that work? So if you're going to a place that's really, really busy and, you know, a lot of places are going cashless now, and you go in there and you hit that tip option and you give them a 10% tip on your purchase, like, does that person who served you even get that tip? Like, does it go into a big pool and then it all gets divided? We are so far off topic right now, but
yeah.
It doesn't really matter. I don't know. Like my stance on the whole thing is like, if there's a service provided, I'll tip. If I'm just walking up to a counter and bringing a product, scanning it, paying for it, I'm sorry. I'm going to hit no tip every time. And I don't care if people see me do it. It's, Hate me if you want, but I feel like most people probably feel the same way, that this tipflation has gotten out of control and now everybody wants a tip for everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, provide me a good service, I'm happy to tip and tip generously.
No, I love that. Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's cool. Yeah, I see on social media, people are bringing this topic up quite a bit. It's crazy, but
Pandemic, it's
I
getting out of
forget.
hand.
Yeah, I forget where what rabbit hole we
No.
went down here. Did you ask me a question?
No. Okay, so what I was saying was, is there anything even available? So the viewer had asked, okay, so, you know, I should have hope. You know, I should try and get a mortgage. Don't lose hope. There's options out there for everybody. But okay, so say she saves up some money, and you know, everything's really expensive right now and wages are not high. So this is a single income person, right? They don't have a spouse, so household income is just their income and they're paying for groceries, things like that. The question is, you know, is there anything that's affordable or that is worth buying? And this is kind of a question that was more so aimed at me as a real estate agent, but will apply to you as well. And I would say that definitely there, if I pull up the MLS right now, there are single detached homes for everybody of all kinds of different price ranges in the low 100,000s, all the way up, obviously, to as high as you want to spend on real estate. Now, I will say, people will say, well, it's not worth buying. Well, you know what? That's not necessarily true, but I will say that the things that are out there that are below $200,000, you're going to have to understand that these are not going to be palaces, but it is a starting point and it's something that you own versus something that you're paying rent on. So if you're paying rent right now, you're paying for someone's mortgage plus a little bit more. So you can already afford a mortgage. That's how I look at it. Whether you qualify is a different story, but if you qualify, you can already afford it. You're paying your rent. Now, you might have to take a step backwards because maybe you're renting somewhere that's really nice and shiny and is in good shape and you've kept good care of it. If you purchase something and you can only afford $200,000, now you might have to take a look at what the market is and just know going into it that, hey, you know what? I'm gonna have to buy something here where I'm gonna have to put some TLC into it. Buying turnkey is probably not an option for you. You might have to buy something knowing, hey, we're gonna have to put a little elbow grease into it, clean it, live with older appliances, dated interiors, things like that. You're not gonna get brand new, but you will own it. It'll be yours. It's a chance for you to build some equity, and then you could always move up to something else. And before you know it, you know, with the way that the market has been, I mean, the market's slow right now, but I still see sale prices increasing, just increasing slower than they have been. Give it 5 years and then take a look at what you've got, and maybe you can sell it, move on to something better, or just continuously invest into that product. The question I had for you, Paul, was you see a variety of different mortgages. Like, what are the price points that people are buying at, like from the lowest to the highest that you're seeing out there?
Yeah, I know. And you're not wrong in that it's a bit challenging on a single income these days to buy something that is turnkey, right? And unless you have a significant down payment, because like I mentioned earlier, the rough math on the mortgage amount someone can get is, well, I mean, it used to be four times your income, but because of the interest rates, it's more like 3.75 times your income with limited or no monthly other debts. So, you know, someone making, you know, $60,000 a year, you know, might get approved for a $200,000 mortgage if they have no debts. And 60 grand's a great income, but it's just based on the math right now, it's a bit challenging. So you have to have a significant down payment to build that up, right? If you get approved for 190 or 200, then if you have a $100,000 down payment, well, boom, now you're at 300, right? 325. But you know, I've done some purchases for 160 fixer uppers where the client was handy and his dad was handy and they were gonna spend the weekend and evenings redoing the drywall and the carpet and the kitchen and the bathroom, and now that's a home to grow a family in. You know, it's tough to get over a purchase price of, you know, 300 to or more on your own, 350 on your own. But now if you have significant income, you're making 100K a year, then yeah, there's some options. But I would say, like you mentioned, you're gonna have costs, so you have to always factor in, all right, even though your rent is paying, you were paying 1500 a month before, and your mortgage payment is 1500. You have to also factor in property taxes, you know, home and fire insurance, water, hydro. So there, I do a whole walkthrough, and I'm sure you do as well, looking at the different costs that are associated with buying, right? But
Yeah,
there's definitely
absolutely.
options. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. No, and that's good. And then options outside of budget too. There's different types of homes. You know, it's not always the 1200 square foot bungalow, three bedroom, two bath with white picket fence in suburbia, right? For folks where the amount that they have to spend is really challenging, there's condos, right? You can get a condominium, which is a nice place where it's in a building that has other amenities. Purchase price can be a lot lower. Mobile homes that we've discussed that here for a few minutes before we got on the call. A little bit more of a tricky situation, but still can be an option depending on the circumstances. There's options out there for everybody. So I guess the whole theme of this show before we wrap it up is that, hey, don't give up hope. Don't think that I'm untouchable. No one's going to give me a mortgage. The bank is happy to take your money and make a profit on it. I think it's from a real estate perspective, always strive to own instead of rent. Don't let your age be a factor or anything like that. Definitely explore the options, talk to some professionals. And if you have questions, call us. That's what we're here for. We answer questions, we put people's minds at ease. And I think that that should be your number one step. If you're somebody like this viewer, start talking, put a plan in place. If we can't do it with you today, we could set you up so that you're able to maybe buy something in the near future, in the next year or two. We can give you that checklist. This is what you got to do. And for some people, you know, that might be all you need is that list. I remember before I bought my first property, I had no idea. You know, it just seemed like this impossible task that you had to be a millionaire in order to own a house. And it's just simply not true. But having that plan, you know, went to the bank, got that checklist, and it was just like, okay, do this, do this, do this, do this, and then you can go shopping. And it was like, oh, it's that simple. So talk to a professional, talk to Paul, talk to a realtor like myself, and we're happy to put you on the path to home ownership.
Yep. And it's as simple as a 5-minute phone call. It's free. There's no, you don't have to tip me. There's no cost to using a mortgage broker at all. I mean, if you're a standard mortgage, no costs, no fees, no tips. And I'm always happy to give you a unbiased opinion on whatever your bank's giving you. I'll let you know if they are giving you a good deal. And even if they are giving you a good deal, I'll let you know if you can get approved for more elsewhere. So yeah, keep me in touch.
Right on, man. Okay, well, thanks for the great chat today. This has been another great episode of the Selling Houses Podcast. If you like the show, if you found this helpful, subscribe so that you get the notification when we post another one next week. We're going to try and keep them out coming every week. And that's all I got for today, Paul. Unless you got anything else?
No, thanks again, Ty. And looking forward to more in the future. Talk soon. Mm-hmm.